Welcome to the Tater Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, and I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we have a very special guest. Netfa Freeman is an organizer in Pan-American Community Action. That's PACA.
And Pan-African.
Pan-African. What did I say?
Pan-American.
We'll include Pan-American. My apologies. And the coordinating committee of Black Alliance for Peace. Netfa is also co-host, producer of the WPFW radio station and podcast, Voices with Vision. Netfa, welcome to the show. We're really glad to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I remember that we used to talk a little bit a few years ago about Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm. And I guess along the way, I'm going to ask you what Zimbabwe makes of this. There is a problem. It seems to me your organization and those demonstrating now across America opposing U.S. intervention, meddling in the Horn of Africa. This is a long story, isn't it? It goes back.
It does go back. I want to try to give the short version of it and the summary of it. And right now, so the main people demonstrating and leading the demonstrations across the U.S., which you pointed out, you know, when we were talking before, are not being covered at all. But these are tens of thousands of people, maybe in the millions when it comes to all the countries that are demonstrating. I mean, all the locations, cities in the U.S. and some countries outside. These are Ethiopian people. But what's unique about it is that they are also being joined by Eritrean folks and other people now across Africa and in the U.S., people from other countries, but even Black people, because that's what, you know, we are. And so what they're protesting is U.S. interference in the affairs of Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa in general, and that the U.S. has been giving ultimatums and accusing the Ethiopian government of repression and saying it's, you know, no democracy, all that kind of, we've heard these kind of accusations before when imperialism wants to do this against a country. And they've put sanctions both on Eritrea and Ethiopia. And one of the things that's happened that I think is maybe the threat there, a few of the things, it's a lot of things there. That one is that seems to be the elephant in the room that hardly gets talked about is China. But Ethiopia is the largest fastest growing economy on the African continent right now. It's also very strategically placed in the Horn of Africa, and then has a project, the Grand Renaissance Dam, which they don't want to see those kind of projects happen. And then their ally in Egypt, U.S. ally in Egypt, is also complaining about this project. The relatively new government in Ethiopia, which came to power in only 2018, has brokered a peace agreement between Eritrea and Somalia and Ethiopia. Prior to that, there was, you know, war going on. The U.S. Actually used Ethiopia to invade Somalia this time, and also doesn't like Eritrea, because Eritrea is also the only country in Africa that does not have a U.S.-Africa command presence. That's AFRICOM. That's the U.S. militarized presence on the continent of Africa. And so, I mean, I'm probably not missing something, but these are the general things. And so as recently, the U.S. has been threatening and posturing Ethiopia to bend to its will. It's been using as a proxy the group TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which actually was in power in Ethiopia from 1990 until 2018, when a popular movement across the number of ethnicities and people in Ethiopia called for, you know, a change, and they deposed them through an election. And so now there's a democratically elected government, And it's you know, looking at a national Ethiopia, and that now the same, and it should be important, and I'm just going to end here because you might have some specific questions, but the to separate the TPLF from Tigray and people, because it's not necessarily representative of the will of Tigrayan people. So as while it's a political formation, there are Tigrayan people who do not stand for what the TPLF is doing and its relationship with the U.S. and the U.S. support really is what's destabilizing this situation. The claims of misinformation and the sanctions and the, you know, posture against the Eritrea and Ethiopia is not productive. It's not helpful.
This is, we're speaking to Netva Freeman, and this thing about the how it all began, it seems to be lost here, isn't it? That there was actually quite a remarkable political development. The current president or prime minister, I forget his title, was very popularly elected. He won a Nobel Prize. That seems to be a curse these days, getting a Nobel Prize. of course, people expected to see an implementation of policies. My understanding is quite a remarkable breakthrough was made with Eritrea, where it was his gesture of conciliation and friendship. And frankly, I remember people sort of throwing their hats in the air. Good, this is a very good development. And now he's been turned into, according to U.S. propaganda, a leader who's guilty of genocide and aggression. And but how did this start? Who was actually the aggressor in the current violence inside Ethiopia?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a sensitive topic to not be from that region and to kind of put it out there, but you know, the facts speak for themselves, and I guess we have to say so. In November, just past November, not November. I mean, I'm so. Oh, it's already been a year already. So not this past, but a year ago, the TPLF took it upon itself to attack a military base, Ethiopian military base in that region, and so that was the first assault that kicked off. Now, what is a, you know, is a, you could, I don't know if you want to call it a civil war, but yeah, I guess. And so that's where the all of the claims of genocide and those kind of things have started. And then also the Western posture. There are some accounts that say that the TPLF would not have had the motivation to do that without Western support. In fact, prior to that, their predisposition was kind of a secessionist movement claims and that kind of thing. And it seems, you know, with the different, given the sides and disposition of the Western forces, then that, you know, that doesn't seem unreasonable. Yeah. But since then, you know, in spite of the United Nations, which, you know, when claims of genocide are given, people rarely, it's a very touchy thing, and people rarely defer to the definitions, the international legal definitions of genocide. And when bodies like the United Nations, which actually define these things, come in and do an investigation, you know, these kind of things don't, they get swept under the rug in the media. The UN has done that investigation in this situation. It said it does not meet the qualifications of genocide. And then if you notice also, even despite the posture of the officials like Blinken or who, U.S. Anthony, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken or whoever, they actually never use those terms. So what it is, it's just really about media on the ground misinformation to kind of make it charged to try to create some dissension and disunity among regular people, because regular people just don't, you know, we tend not to be that critical of what are these definitions and things like that, and then what are the players involved. But it starts with a year ago with that kicking off of that. And since then, there's been an offensive, there's been a couple offensives and battles. And what the Ethiopian government says is that what they were doing, because an offensive against a military base inside a country is obviously, you know, it's illegal for that country. No country would condone that. So they call it a law and order exercise. That's what they've been saying, is it to bring criminals to justice. And so And then that, you know, that's what they're, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Netva Freeman, and I'm curious about the where the weapons might be coming from in the case of the Tigray Liberation Forces. They seem to have sophisticated weapons, and many people are curious, where did they get all this firepower?
Right, that's a good question, and you know, one of the that's something we've asked too, and I hate to like speculate without having anything, but when it comes to U.S. support for stuff, we asked the same thing in Libya with the those groups that were against. But in this instance, we might want to be careful about, you know, speculating, because some say, well, because the TPLF used to be in power, there was a opportunities for them to kind of hoard and store things from the national armories and things like that. But we also know that the United States is not, it's not beneath them to supply arms to groups that they want to make sure keep it up, keep up the fighting and the aggression and destabilization, while on the outside they talk about, you know, wanting to restore peace and stability and all those kind of things. So I don't really know. Those are the two possibilities. It's either Western supplied and them having gotten them from before, or maybe a little bit of both.
Again, it's Netva Freeman, and Mr. Freeman is an organizer of the Pan-African Community Action, and he is a co-host and producer of WPFW radio show and podcast Voices with Vision. Netva, you know, it strikes me there's a kind of pattern when the U.S. wants to get involved, and I know these demonstrations are focused on trying to alert the American people to how dangerous U.S. policies are, but they really, when I read the media, they say, well, now it's an autocratic regime and the authoritarian regime, whatever, of Ethiopia, and there's violence. And then they turn to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty, who both say, well, yeah, it's Addis Ababa is the problem. And maybe they have a handful of people who are not in Ethiopia who say that they were victims, but they're laying the groundwork sufficient for their game of intervention, right?
Yes, and it's a very dangerous game that they're playing here. And I think also we can't understand the situation within just the context, relegated to the context of the one country, that we really have to look at the region and actually also even the world. The United States is in a cold war with China and seems to make no bones about turning that into a hot war. China is the biggest investments now in Africa, and it's largely an infrastructural thing through their Belt and Road Initiative, and they're playing a large part in Ethiopia. Right now they're feeling threatened in a lot of ways, you know, because the United States and even really Western Europe in general has prior benefited from much more so their benefit and ability to exploit Africa has been from an unstable Africa. We got to disregard all the rhetoric that they give about anything else. They benefit from extracting raw goods, from exploiting the markets and the labor of the, and they have done nothing in terms of helping Africa develop in terms of infrastructure and things like that. Africa has been largely dependent until the real emergence of China, and still is still not, you know, has largely been dependent on finished goods and things like that, and their economies coming from Western countries, and also aid as a weapon, aid through the international monetary organizations, IMF, World Bank, which put structural adjustment programs on there. China's Belt and Road Initiative, and I'm not trying to glorify China, but it represents something else, and that those agreements are really truly bilateral agreements. They're not the gangsterism, as we would call it, that the United States has. So when any country is trying to start exercising a degree of self-determination and degree in Africa, or even whether it be the Western Hemisphere or anywhere, then the leaders, then they start looking at leaders. They start using the demonization, confining the analysis to the leader, Abior, or you could even say Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they want us to, you know, have a very overly simplistic view of what's happening. Therefore, they can misinform and create misunderstanding, confusion around a situation and distract from their machinations and their maneuvers, their geostrategic maneuvers. And in this instance, you know, there's the, I've mentioned the Grand Renaissance Dam. There are choke points where they're considered choke points in Africa that they want to be and not just in Africa, but in this particular region where the Red Sea is, the Bab el Mandeb Strait. It's a choke point critical of securing global energy through there. I mean, there's a lot there, and that and the fact that China represents an alternative for leadership. And even this, you know, despite the class relationship of that leadership in Africa, the fact that they offer this alternative threatens the interest of not just the United States, but we really need to look at Western imperialism in general, the NATO countries in particular.
I was struck by the posture of Joe Biden only a month or two back. He said, of China, he said, the American leadership is concerned about the development of China. And he said, we will never allow it to develop to be the world leader in economy. And he wasn't talking just to China. He's talking to Ethiopia, Eritrea, all African states, all those who are wishing to and working to develop. And he's saying, I can draw the line and you will stop developing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very serious, as I read it, I mean, he's telling the world, no, we're the masters and we were not going to tolerate challenge.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what it is, it's not just Africa, it's also the Western Hemisphere, because also that goes not just, and it's China, but it's also the fact that other countries, but it's more so in the Western Hemisphere where they're, but it's also around the world, they're forming what would be tantamount to years ago, the non-aligned movement. And really trying to look at how do we create a situation where we're not so not dominated by these Western powers that really don't help, you know, us with our what Joe Biden is doing when he's expressing it. This is just Joe Biden, the person, the spokesperson for really imperialism and U.S. leading these NATO forces, is that neoliberalism as a system really doesn't have anything to offer. I mean, if you think about it, there's not even things that are being like tangible manufactured products or anymore. There's a large what would be considered under capitalism a disposable or a surplus population of people they can't provide for. There's no jobs, things are being automated, and that around the world there are people also standing up trying to harness like what's theirs, their resources and things like that. So when they're really in a state of desperation as not being the world power, and this is what, for them, it's either that or be nothing or non-existent. That's how, you know, the global elite see that. And so what he's expressing is their desperation. And so right now, even with Blinken is in a tour in Africa right now, he's been sent to Africa and he's touring Africa and he's met with Kenya and I think Nigeria. And what you can see with the reports is that they're having to change, they're having to tailor what used to be a much more paternalistic posture toward African countries and saying, oh, we have to look at Africa as a serious player in the global thing. They're trying to be much more respectful and even entertaining, trying to have their own version of infrastructural development for Africa. A little bit too late, too little, too late.
Build back better.
International version of build back better. And then what you just mentioned, though, is also significant. And this is something that Blinken mentioned in a thing, they're talking about democracy and have to actually admit that the U.S. has issues with democracy because of that. What happened in January 6th and all that. But in the U.S., there's a serious domestic issue going on, a crisis. It's a crisis of legitimacy. It's a crisis of, you know, jobs and all that COVID has experienced. I mean, has exposed all of this. And that now the standing in the U.S., they're not looked at as in such high regard anymore. So there's all of that that I think playing in Ethiopia. And what now with Ethiopia and what they didn't, I don't know how they didn't expect, but it's they're so used to the colonial posture, is the masses of Ethiopians, because they have been, you know, masses of Ethiopians and also Eritreans are coming together and saying, no, you know, there's large diaspora populations in other countries too. And that they're seeing that the conditions in their country are really exacerbated by the West, led by the United States. And they're standing up, and they didn't expect that. These demonstrations we're seeing today, I can't imagine that they expected that to happen. They believe their own hogwash when they say these things. And so it's hard for them to expect, to anticipate that so many people would have come together like this. So I think it poses a real, a threat. And for us, it's not a threat. It's an opportunity for us to actually have some real people-centered unity around real people-centered human rights and, you know, like self-determination and decolonization.
Yeah, isn't it? It's actually, you know, you could see it as a continuum, right? That these many years ago, it was Black Americans who took to the streets in thousands opposing Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia.
That's right.
And it was a great awakening.
That's right.
And the media kept looking the other way, but the Black Americans were actually in the street. And figures like Joe Louis, the great heavyweight champion, he spoke up on the matter. I've always was struck by the fact that he knocked out an Italian who was supposed to be the champion. And people continually say, oh, and he knocked out the German. He knocked out the Italian. And that was the one, the knockout that was celebrated by Black Americans.
That's right.
I can't even think of that guy's name, thank heaven. But but there is a history showing that, a continuum, I would say, that hasn't gone away. But for a period there, there was hegemony, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be breaking up. And it might be a good time to remind the world that it was the African countries that put the issue of China's recognition on the agenda at the United Nations and then won it. They got recognition for mainland China. And when there was a little maneuver to bring in Taiwan as some kind of a half country or something, they defeated it. And if you look at the pictures of the delegates, they were all applauding when they defeated this entity that they now call Taiwan. It used to be Formosa. But this unity between the developing countries and frankly, China and today, latter day, Russia, it is a new political reality, right? And all kinds of opportunities are opening up.
Yeah, it's a new political reality. And I think, I think what we have to do in terms of the working class masses is have to see, and particularly the people of color, particularly people of African descent. Because like one of the things you mentioned that made me think of this, and I think is related to what you just said, is that, you know, back then when the people stood up against the fascism that was trying to take over Ethiopia, since then, the United States, and it's kind of like a propaganda kind of thing, they have imbued us with a sense of being this American, like the interests of America are, we share the same interests, really not even just America, really we're talking about an oligarchy of America. And so we embrace America and Americanism, and we want to be American, and have kind of sidelined any interest of not anything that we see in anything that should be gleaned from a sharing interest in Africa or Black people around the world. And we, the real notion that we're colonized people in the settler colony is very important to actually for us forging a way forward. And so right now with what's happening actually presents an opportunity to one for Black people of African descent to come together, but also for that also to recognize this is part and parcel of a global, you know, working class movement that should be standing up against the concentration of wealth and power by the global oligarchy and the elite. And that we have to, you know, there's a whole lot of things we have to reverse. The climate change stuff, the extractive industries, the poverty, the, you know, basic human rights need to be like people-centered human rights, like not the liberal human rights, freedom of speech and all that stuff, but healthcare, education, housing, you know, a right to a job, some basic stuff needs to be reestablished. And I think we're in a time and where there's movements that are realizing that. We kind of got off the thing, but I think what the global leaders trying to do is distract. They're trying to keep that from coming together on an international basis, that because we do have to act internationally. They've globalized their own exploitation, and so we have to respond and figure out how ways to respond both locally, but in a way that connects internationally.
We're speaking to Netfa Freeman, and he is organizer in Pan-African Community Action, Coordinating Committee of the Black Alliance for Peace. By the way, there are great websites to connect Black Alliance for Peace. Netfa is also the co-host and producer of WPFW Radio on podcast Voices with Vision. And Netfa, I got to say, my memory has come to my rescue, and it was Primo Canera was the Italian heavyweight champion of the world, knocked out by Joe Louis. It's just, by the way, you know, we talk in history as we go. It's not understood that Black Americans saw that as the most significant fight because that Ethiopia was being invaded
right
at the time that Mr. Canera met us in. A place that I think we really would appreciate knowing more about. Eritrea has been kind of kept off the political and geographic map when Westerners talk about the crisis and problems of Ethiopia. Now, they have had a role here. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so Ethiopia was colonized by Italy, and then was after it overthrew that colonization, it was annexed by the British. So it didn't have the same historical, you know, trajectory in terms of evolution as Ethiopia. So Ethiopia, you know, that was a different issue. As it became annexed, then Ethiopia was kind of given to an Ethiopia by the British, and then they fought, you know, because of I don't remember who was Menelik. I think Menelik was the emperor in Ethiopia, but they end up fighting against that because they had already established their own for the liberation movement, just like the rest of Africa. But now I'm going to fast forward because that's a lot of history there. That Eritrea got its independence after warring with Ethiopia in 1990. Mm-hmm. In 1990, that was also how TPLF came to power, because TPLF and the EPLF, the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, formed an alliance to fight against Mengistu, who was the Mengistu, you know, regime, if you will, in Ethiopia. So when they overthrew them, then Eritrea got its independence, and then shortly after Mengistu was deposed from Ethiopia, and TPLF came to power then. That's when they came to power, and then that they were actually trained by EPLF, trained TPLF, and gave them, you know, and supported TPLF. And so once that happened, the TPLF turned on Ethiopia, and I almost feel slightly uncomfortable talking about it because I'm not a Eritrean or Ethiopian, and it's very sensitive in some of these things. And so that started a new war again over it. Mm-hmm. And so since then, like we talked about, there has been a peace deal brokered, and that now there is obviously there is some forms of cooperation and communication in terms of trying to mitigate the circumstances around the Western aggression against you know, against the region.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, it's such a great accomplishment that that the two leaders met and began to talk about a real cooperation between the two of them. Clearly, the Tigrayan Liberation Front decided they didn't like this kind of development. But I notice that Western press does not treat Ethiopia as a sovereign country, has a right to defend itself. It within that right, to my mind, is the right to invite others to assist them in fighting for their survival. Something which all Western countries say they can do. They make alliances all the time to run to each other's rescue. So Ethiopia seems to be violating the rule, which says that you don't have those rights if you are in the southern part of the hemisphere. If you're in South America, if you're in Africa, you don't have that choice. But I took it as encouraging, actually. I was looking at the Ethiopian government site, and they actually issued a warning to Western media that they don't have any natural right to come in, as they say, and look for the truth. This, we're talking to Netva Freeman. Part of what we're talking about is this media that claims it wants the truth won't even report when demonstrations are happening in Washington, San Francisco, Chicago, Toronto, Houston, across the hemisphere. They do not report it, but they are telling Ethiopia, oh, you have to let us in. I was pleased when the Ethiopian government says, no, you're not going to come here and do anything divisive. If you do, we'll throw you out.
Right. And they have and they're not the only ones who have done this before, but they also have had to do it with USAID and, you know, those agencies, U.S. Agency for International Development, because these agencies, and while the press, the Western press and the private corporations press claim to be independent, they really operate like the fourth branch of the government. And so they tell a narrative and they go in and say what they want, and they'll find, you know, photographs or pictures just to, you know, depict what they want as opposed to the truth. It just doesn't. They serve Western interests. And so any interest that threatens the neocolonial order, you know, then they're not going to really report that.
And do you suppose perhaps the Ethiopian government should offer them to become embedded the way they operate when they work with the Americans? When the U.S. goes to Afghanistan, Iraq, now the reporters happily put on military armor and gear and run around idolizing U.S. forces in other people's countries.
Mm-hmm. And that's the colonial mindset, the colonizer mindset, and that what people on the ground, like those listening to this show, have to start beginning to think in terms of, when we really want to analyze stuff, think about the double standards. Would the United States let countries come in and quote unquote observe their elections or talk about the police killing Black people and indigenous people every 23 hours, you know, and which is what happens, you know. And so they, you know, they would think that was, you know, untenable. They would think that was interference, you know, and they certainly wouldn't allow any of us to take money from these other countries to, you know, to support our organizations here in the United States to do things. They would call that treason. They would find a way to, you know, posture it as treason and throw us in under the prison. But they do this all the time. This is regular. You know, it's interesting, you know, also how I remember the emergence, and this might have been when you and I were first doing these interviews, the emergence of other outlets on the internet that there seemed to be also on the internet, but then on stations, like first it was Al Jazeera, then you had Telesur, and now there's RT, New Russia Today, and then there's Press TV. The emergence, then the United States starts saying, oh, you know, like now when they're on social media, they put a little disclaimer, these social media private corporations will put disclaimers on these things. Some of the disclaimer or warning, these are foreign, or this is owned by the whatever, you know, government or whatever. Yeah. But people don't know that the United States was doing this for years with Voice of America and whatever else. They've been doing for decades, way long before any other countries were doing this. So they really, you know, this hybrid war, as we call it, is they're really at war with the whole people. I mean, we can see it most readily with Ethiopia, but other places, where it's a combination of sanctions, it's a combination of misinformation and media misinformation, and then also support for anything on the ground that will do their bidding and serve their interests as proxies. And so these kind of things are what they've been using to try to exercise full spectrum dominance.
I like that term, as we should remind it, because a few years back, they were beating their chests, saying those words, we have full spectrum dominance. Now, as you point out, that they've created a new word bank, and they've got a bunch of new, but that's what they were going for. Remarkably, we've had these demonstrations now. And I have to tell you, in Toronto, and it's not just one demonstration, these have been going on pretty regularly. I get the impression that this movement's going to grow. I mean, I look at Black Alliance for Peace, and I follow Jammu Baraka, for example, and it's clear that while the mainstream isn't mentioning it, but these movements are not going away.
No. I mean, they can't go away, because for regular people, for humanity, it's either come together or to perish. We don't really have a choice. And that while the global elite will think that everyone will just buy whatever spin they put on it, we actually have to live the realities and the consequences of neoliberalism and hyper-exploitation and whatnot. And that's what really informs people. So at the end of the day, people are going to, you know, realize things and then fight for their interests as a group. So it won't go away. They can only stave it off, but they're not going away.
I get the impression Black Alliance for Peace is playing more and more of a leading role. It's very much to their credit. Netva Freeman, we are very grateful for the time you shared with us. By the way, this is not going away, and we're going to follow this. So I hope we can speak to you again sometime soon in the near future.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very, very much. This is CIUT, The Taylor Reports, 89.5 FM Toronto.